good. Okay, so we're in the middle of a big seminar. We've got about 12 weeks of seminar exploring. The overarching title is The Suprapersonal Force. And what we've been particularly exploring in the last 4 or 5 weeks is ethics, meditation, wisdom. That's the threefold path of Buddhism. So, you know, they do follow on from each other, the evenings, but they're hopefully standalone as well. So if this is your first time, or if you've missed a few, that's fine as well. So last week we were exploring wisdom, and we're going to continue exploring wisdom tonight. And I just put up on the board to put it in context, this threefold way. So according to Buddhism, our root delusion and the thing that causes all our suffering is this delusion of a fixed separate self. I'll be saying a bit more what I mean by that later in the evening. And then from that fixed separate self, that conditions our whole mind and mental events. And then that in turn conditions all our actions in the world. So from that root delusion, everything follows. And what we're doing, one way of looking at this threefold way of ethics, meditation, wisdom, is that we're sort of trying to unpick that whole big ball of tangled mess we made in a way. So we, through ethics, we work on our actions in the world. Through meditation, we work directly on our mind and mental events. And through the cultivation of wisdom, we address that root delusion itself. So that's what I'm going to be continuing exploring tonight. You know, as Jnanavacha hinted at in the announcements, you know, it's something, well, it's a very vast subject, and in a way it's something that we've got to actually, you know, I can only say so much. No matter how wise I was, I'm not that wise, I could only say so much. But I'll say what I can, but then, you know, it's a matter of reflecting and meditating and trying to deepen this experience. So I'm going to base what I'm saying tonight on this book. This is a new book, Living Wisely. It's a book by Sangharakshita, and it's taken from an ancient text called The Precious Garland of Advice for a King, which was... the original text came from the 2nd century by an ancient Buddhist teacher called Nagarjuna, and then Sangharakshita led a seminar on this, and this is the edited transcripts of that seminar. But although the seminar was back in 1976, Sangharakshita, the founder of the Tri Ratna community, he's, in a sense, this is his most recent book, because once it was all edited, like, he kind of pored over it and kind of, you know, has really kind of affirmed that, yes, this is his teaching. So you could say this is the most recent book by Sangharakshita, Living Wisely. I'm going to take what I say tonight on the first couple of chapters of this book. So as I say, this precious garland, or Ratna Mala, as it's called. Ratna means a jewel or precious, and mala, like mala beads that you might see, as like garland. So it's a whole sequence of verses in which this Buddhist monk Nagarjuna explains. You don't know who the king is, but he's explained to some king how to make progress on the path. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to really give you a few extracts from this book of things that really inspired me, and then we can see what we think about them. So last week, for those of us that were here, one of the things Dai Bhadra got us to do is he got us just to think about, well, experiences that have been uplifting. And we did that in little groups, I think in pairs or little groups. Anyway, it was, and I think what Dai Bhadra was trying to illustrate was the point that Sankaracharya is making here, and that Jnanavacha has also made in the tea break. The wisdom isn't just a matter of just thinking. It's not just a cognitive thing. It has got a whole emotional component to it. And so here's what Sangharvasha says. He says you can't say that wisdom, he says you can't speak of it in terms of either knowing or of feeling on their own. He says it's both at once. So once you experience it at a high enough level, he says it's an intuitive understanding and an intuitive feeling. And he says, in other words, at a higher level, there's no real distinction between faith and wisdom. I'm going to come back to what faith means in Buddhism in a minute. And he emphasises this not just here, but in any, you know, again and again in Sangharvasha's teaching, you'll find this emphasised. So he says that they aren't to be experienced separately, the aspect of faith and the aspect of knowing rather than the aspect of feeling, or even jointly. So that's interesting. Not even jointly. It actually goes beyond that. It's that they're completely, there's no distinction. And he said on a kind of more ordinary level, he says it's comparable to the experience of being deeply engaged in conversation. He says you're thinking and feeling at the same time. You can't distinguish between the two. The thought's the feeling's the thought. And he says that the attainment of wisdom on a much higher level is like that. So here's a bit I really like and find quite intriguing what he says next. He says, in a gardener's aim in the precious garland, he says it's not to generate an understanding of the Dharma in the king, but to generate the Dharma itself. So that's an interesting distinction, isn't it? So it's not an understanding of the Dharma here meaning truth in the king, but to generate the Dharma itself. And he says, just as the Buddha is described not as speaking about the Dharma, but as speaking Dharma. He says, Nagarjuna doesn't want to talk about the truth, he wants to awaken the truth. He says he's reminding the king of the king's inherent potential for enlightenment, for establishing the practices and thereby becoming a vessel for the Dharma. So again, there's a lot just in those last few sentences. I thought that's interesting as we're becoming a vessel for the Dharma. The whole seminar, as I was saying, is on the super-personal force of something that's beyond us, as it were, that floods through us, that we become a vessel for. And this is what the real aim of Buddhist practice is. So Nagarjuna doesn't want to talk about the truth, he wants to awaken truth. So I don't know, I thought I might just pause there and see if there's any responses to that little bit so far. What do people make of that distinction between it's not speaking about the Dharma but speaking Dharma?
When you speak about something, it's an intellectual understanding.
Yeah.
and the emphasis is on more intuition rather than intellectual understanding.
The emphasis is definitely trying to take it away from just merely intellectual understanding. As Jnanavacha said, views do matter, but it's much more than that. Yeah.
I think it strongly reminds me of the phrase that the Dharma must be caught, not taught. It's that idea that, you know, it's awakened in someone, you can't just stick it to someone, it's arise within.
Yeah. And again, you've got that thing of something being awakened or sparked off, haven't you? It's something, it makes me think of it's something alive, it's like a living force, Yes,
What it sounds like to me is it's someone who's, but it's like passion. And exuberance. And inspiration.
Yeah.
And are all those things the same as this force or this wisdom, because you can experience all of those qualities,
yeah,
but that might be misguided.
Yes, it might be mindful. So that's good, isn't it? So you could have passion for, well, lots of things, couldn't you? And it could be misguided. So I think that's brilliant to bring that out, that in a way it's the sort of, that's why it's both together. So you have to have the right view. So though it's not merely intellectual understanding, you have to have the right view in order to be able to trust your passion, as it were. But the view without the passion just becomes mere knowledge. So you need, I think that's getting at how you've got both of these completely working together at its highest. So
yeah. But then it depends on what you decide is your right view and what the truth is, because that, and then how do you know that you're right? Yeah, how do you know you're right? Because then you might actually be wrong.
Yeah. Any ideas? Yeah, because that's a very good. Yeah, you might, exactly. You might be, mightn't you? Yeah, you might be very passionate again about all sorts of things.
Yeah.
So.
And if you're just feeling it and you just have a sense of what is right,
yeah,
in yourself, that might not be the best way of acting.
No, might not. So, what do you think? Well, how do you think you could?
Possess some kind of force that's stronger than them, and that they're, you know, they have this zeal about them,
yeah,
and it's quite intoxicating,
uh-huh,
and it's quite persuasive,
yeah.
But how do you know that is actually right?
Mm-hmm.
How does anyone know that that's right? I could just pretend to be. I could do that.
Yeah, well, you could more than pretend, you could be completely convinced,
yeah,
couldn't you?
Yeah, you could be convinced.
Yeah. So, anybody got any thoughts on how would you... Again, it's almost like, well, how would you protect yourself from just being carried along by a sort of real sort of fervour, zeal that...
I think resonates with... It's something that's in you all the time that you uncover and find.
But again, how would you know that? How would you know that it really is the truth?
Because you just know physically and in your heart, and yeah, physically and in your heart, your brain doesn't might be selling you all sorts of rubbish.
So is that enough? Do people think that's enough just to know physically and in your heart? Are there any advances on that? Let's have someone who, maybe we'll give someone who hasn't spoken yet, because I heard a few voices over here.
I was thinking similarly, but for me anyway, it's about whether it resonates with your experience.
Okay.
And I don't, you know, as you were saying, I don't think it's just experience in your mind, it's experience in your heart as well. So in a way I think we all know what wisdom and truth is. It's a question of resonating with that. So for me it's about your own experience.
Okay, so we've got quite a few votes for your own experience, but I don't think that's going to convince Suella, because I think that goes round. I think that goes round, but then in a way that's what you're saying, it's like, it's back to, well, how do you know your own experience? Yeah, so we've got, yeah.
Maybe it's to do with the actions that come from that belief. Because if it's a zeal and a fervour for something that's untrue, your actions are likely to be damaging.
Okay, right. So that would be a way of testing. That would be, yeah, so damaging what, to other people, to your...
Yeah, to other
yeah.
people, to yourself.
Yeah, uh-huh, yeah. So that would be interesting. And in a way that's, well, I feel on safer ground there, because it's sort of getting us, if we look at this model of ethics, meditation, wisdom, you could see, well, are my actions harming other people or myself? And which, if they are, you could be sure there's probably something a bit dodgy going on, no matter how fervently you feel, so that could be a good test. Anything else? There was another, and then I'll come to Tony.
I was just thinking of it that leads to freedom and kind of testing it with a perspective larger than ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Circle and check it out with others.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
So you check it out with a perspective that's larger than yourself. So I'm in a way that, and it's interesting because that might bring us back to, well, it's a traditional teaching about we can rely to some extent on our own experience, but we've also got to rely on those who we think are wiser and who've got a bigger perspective. So testing it.
Yeah, and possibly it needs to be kind of on a global scale. Because if you just test it out with certain people that you sample, that you know that have the same interests as you, then that's not going to be the whole picture.
Yeah.
Something you need to go beyond. I don't know. Anyway, that's.
Yeah, you'd have to be prepared for it to stand up widely. So I think there was a few, I'm trying to take people in order, so Tony, then Heather, and then...
Yeah, I don't think you can rely on yourself.
Uh-huh.
I'm in the same ballpark as Andy, but I would identify the Aryan Sangha and people like Bhante, our own teachers in the order, and that would be my guidance, my guiding.
Mm-hmm.
As to whether I'm going in the right direction or not.
Okay. Yeah, so again, you'd look to the sort of testimony of the wise as you see them.
Specific
yeah.
testimony of the
Sangha.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah, and
Heather? Yeah, I was just thinking when we had the discussion before the break, and I was trying to think, I was struggling to think of it like a wiser person.
Mm.
But I thought of friend, a very old friend who I've recently had a bit of a conflict with, and what came reflecting on that conflict, I kind of learnt something about myself which kind of I think sort of helped me become wiser about some aspect of my character, why I'd come into conflict with her. So it's a sort of a way of testing, testing your opinions, your beliefs. It can be against someone you might not agree with.
Okay, I see what you mean. Yeah.
Throw up.
Yeah.
You sort of reflected on her thoughts, but also on my own, and learned something about myself.
Yeah.
You know, why I'd come into conflict with that person.
Yes. Well, that's, and maybe that links a bit with Andy's point about not just testing your ideas with people you think will agree with you. So I think this is so. It's unreal because it's quite crucial, this, because we, on one hand, we do need to engage our emotions and our passion, but we can't just be carried away. Like Buddhism would say, you can't just be carried away with that only. We do need to. We can't leave our intellect out of the picture. So we do. So that's why Buddhism also does emphasise right view. So you've got this. You've got Buddhism saying, don't just rely on understanding, but at the same time, you can't just throw understanding out completely. You've got to have both understanding and the passion. Yeah. So you've got to look at. Well, you do, if you want to be a Buddhist, you do have to study, well, what are the Buddhist teachings? What does it rest on? Yeah? And you've got to be secure in that. And you've got to know that. And I think the person that brought up looking at your actions in the world, that's also a good test. You've got to know, well, my actions, because you're... your actions will be coloured by your views. So that's quite a good kind of litmus test. If you find yourself being unkind and harming people and yourself, you can think, oh, I need to sort of go back and look at, well, what are my views that are underpinning. Yeah. Do you want to add anything into that? Yeah,
no, but in a way you said it, but I think it might just be worth saying. Look, so there's this trusting your own experience, but even that, you've got to take over quite a long perspective. So one of the tests of truth is that you won't find it contradicted in your own experience. So you've got to take a longer term snapshot of your experience than just a day or a week. If Buddhism says all things are impermanent, you've got to look at that in the light of a longer perspective. But yes, you can trust your own experience. But then, as Subhadramati is saying, you can also look to what the Buddha taught. Now that, you could say, why should I trust the Buddha? But you've got to start somewhere. So if we're all here because we must have some sort of intuition that Buddhism has something to offer, the teachings of the Buddha have something to offer. So then you can look to what the Buddha taught. But you can do that not just with blind faith, you can then be evaluating that all the time in your own experience again. Do you see what I mean? So you're doing this dual kind of thing between the teachings and what the Buddha taught. And then it said that you can also look to other people who you think are practicing Buddhism more experienced in Buddhism than you are. And what do they think? But again, you can't take it on blind faith. You've got to keep your wits about you because those people are probably not fully and perfectly enlightened. So they're going to be flawed human beings. So then you can't completely suspend your own judgment, your critical judgment, at the same time. Do you see what I mean? So you've got all these kind of factors. Primarily you've got your own experience and then you've got the teachings. But you've got to take a very intelligent kind of course with both of them.
Yeah. Good. Okay, so I want to move on. Yeah, just take one more point, Jade, and then I'll go on. Yeah, good.
Yeah, I was just wondering about right view and how you evaluate whether something is a right view or not.
Mm-hmm.
So say you take the Buddha and his teachings as a starting point.
Mm-hmm.
This idea of right view, how do you decide whether what you're looking at is a right view or not?
Well, probably, but you have to test it. I think a bit like Jnanavajra said, so if the view was all things are impermanent or all things arise and depends on conditions, you could really examine that and say, well, you could say, but you could almost be a bit devil's advocate, couldn't you? You could think, well, I'm going to try and find one thing that isn't impermanent. You know, so you could really, you know, sort of deeply reflect like that.
I have a question. So in terms of this, about being right, so there must be a wrong for there to be a right. So is it kind of like, if you do the right thing, or if you have the right point of view, then you have sort of a grasp of the truth kind of thing? Is it, because I don't quite believe in the whole thing about right and wrong. I don't know, I think people have very different standards for what is right and what is wrong, looking from different points of view, so...
I'll say a little about that, and then I'll move on. But it's good to bring that up. So sometimes we use right and wrong in two ways. So we can talk about moral right and wrong, and we can also, so that'd be one way of talking about right and wrong. Buddhism doesn't particularly do that, to talk about moral right and wrong. I think that might be what you mean when you say different standards. But Buddhism also does talk about right view and wrong view, but both those terms are provisional. Yeah? So, for example, Buddhism would say to like something that Paul has said a few times, that all things are impermanent. You know, so there are some views that are called right view as opposed to wrong view, but even that's provisional, because actually the Buddha said to have no view. In other words, that when you come to perfect wisdom, you go beyond views altogether. But you've got to be careful that you don't try and jump to no view before you understand the difference between what's been called right view and wrong view. But what I would say is, I wouldn't get too hung up on those words right and wrong just now. All I'm trying to say is, this was all in response to how do we make sure we're not getting carried away with the fervour and zeal of our own emotion. And I'm saying, all we're saying is, you know, forget about right and wrong in a way for a moment. Just kind of think that you've got to not leave your intelligence behind as well. So Buddhism isn't asking us to leave our intelligence and our brain behind when it talks about also including the heart and the emotions. That's all that's been said here. You know, that's all that's been said here, yeah? So I'll just follow on from that thing, because I just wanted to say, because I mentioned faith earlier, what Sangharakshita did. So earlier Sangharakshita says, what does he say? The highest level, there's no real distinction between faith and wisdom. But I want to just qualify what he means by faith, because as Jnanavacha says, it's not a sort of blind belief. And how Sangharakshita defines it here, he says, when it's linked with wisdom, faith is a total emotional response. He says, even an aesthetic response to the spiritual ideal. Yeah. So you can, again, he's trying to illustrate that something very heartfelt, and it's akin to what you might feel if you just looked at something very, very beautiful. It's just this heartfelt response. I don't know if any of you have people been in our shrine room downstairs, the basement shrine room? Have people been down there? And you know, we've got that triptych picture, then it's got some doors that close. Well, my friend Su Yen was telling me, she said, oh, she was doing a course down there, one of the breathing space courses, and throughout the course they had the doors closed. And because it's not really, in a way we're not particularly talking about Buddhism explicitly on that course, but then some of the people on the course said, oh, what's behind those doors on the last night? And the leader opened the door, and Su Yen said, everybody in the room just went, oh! Yeah, and there was just this lovely moment. So I think, that's the aesthetic response. You know, you would see the Buddha and you just go, oh! So that's what Sangharakshita is. That's a sort of glimpse of it, yeah. But it'd be a total emotional response. It would transform your whole life, if you like, in its fullness. And it's enjoyable, you know. He says it's a deep enjoyment of the contemplation of the ideal. It's not just a belief in this or that doctrine. He says it's a response of delight and fascination. Again, he says in that emotional response that you'd have a bit like to a beautiful painting or landscape or piece of music. And he said, I like this because it ties in with the there's not blind belief. He says, in Buddhism, faith, he says, it's not a sort of investment plan. He says it's not that you're sort of just putting in loads of laborious practice now in the belief that, you know, one day you'll sort of get your reward someplace else. So it's not that. It's a sort of sense of rejoicing in the Buddha's full realization of his spiritual potential. But it's also, and this is really important, it's the trust that you yourself are capable of that, that that's a human ideal that every human being is capable of if we put the effort in. So that's what faith is in Buddhism. And it's, again, it's this interesting thing, and you might have experienced this. He says, at the same time, he said, like, sometimes, do you find this in your Buddhist practice, that you can be sort of suffering and happy at the same time, in a way? You get a few nods. That you're, I mean, you might be experiencing real suffering, but you've got happiness in a deeper, it's deeper than a sort of just pleasure, and that's the happiness that comes from faith. You might be experiencing difficulty at the moment, you might be experiencing difficulty in your Dharma practice, but in your heart of hearts, you know you're on the right track. You couldn't turn back, you're not going to give it up. Yeah, some few people got a taste of that. If you haven't, then if you keep on practicing, you will, believe me. You know, you will. There'll be times when you think, oh God, this is really difficult. But at the same time, there's somebody to say to you, okay, you don't need to do it. You can just stop now. You wouldn't want to, because you know, actually, although it's difficult, I actually know this is part of it and I'm on the right track. So that's faith, yeah? It's a deeper, there is a sort of paradoxically a happiness even within a painful time, and it's a happiness that's deeper than just momentary pleasure. Yeah. So that's that wasn't really anyway what I like totally wanted to say, but I thought I would just I thought I wanted to draw out this the emotional, you know, that it's a heartfelt emotional thing. So I'm gonna go on a bit now, before I run out of time totally, to talk a little bit more about what's on the board here, about this notion of this root delusion, yeah? And this is, I really do recommend you getting this book. This is the kind of main content of chapter 2 of this book. So Buddhism proper, as it were, the sort of true Dharma, is completely addressing itself to this illusion of the fixed separate self. This is what the heart of Buddhism is about, and this is what makes Buddhism particular. Yeah, this is Buddhism particular among sort of different beliefs and religions and so on, that Buddhism in particular is addressing itself to this. So what it's saying is that what we experience as the I, what I experience as myself, what you experience as yourself, is not an ultimately real entity. So that is the kind of root delusion. But we've got to be careful. Yeah, we've got to be very careful with this teaching, because it could easily sound like that means that that Buddhism's trying to tell us that we don't exist, which probably, well, depending on our temperament. Well, I was going to say it doesn't sound very palatable. I mean, depending on our temperament, we might enjoy that idea, or we might think, oh, I don't like the sound of that. You know, it's easy to feel that this teaching is negating our whole being. And if we did think that, if we thought that that's what it was, then, well, I don't know, it wouldn't sound very appealing, really. Well, it wouldn't sound very appealing to me if I thought that that's what Buddhism was saying. But actually, it doesn't mean that, right? So this is the important thing. It doesn't mean, it's not trying to negate our being. What it's trying to say is that what we take for ourselves isn't everything, yeah? So it's not that we're completely non-existent or unreal. It's that we don't exist in the way that we think we do. That there's actually more to us than we think there is. Maybe even that's not quite the right way of putting it. Maybe a more accurate way of putting it is that there's another dimension of our experience that's more real. And in contrast with that more real, what we take to be real at the moment is limited and illusory. Yes? Shall I say that again? So it's not saying that we're completely non-existent. It's saying that there's another dimension of experience that's more real. And in contrast with that, this reality is illusory. Any responses to that so far? Does that make sense, at least on an intellectual level, of the sort of doctrine, as it were? So, well, maybe I'll carry on. So it's said, so this teaching is said to be, if we really could grasp that, basically, we would have nothing to fear anymore. We'd have nothing to protect, because what we do is we have this root delusion as I, and then we set about protecting it. Because we've got it, we're compelled to everything that seems a threat to it, we'll want to push away, and everything that seems to enhance it, we'll want to pull towards us. And Buddhism says basically that's quite, we cause ourselves a lot of unnecessary trouble by doing that. If we could actually see through that illusion, we'd be totally free, and in particular we'd be free from fear, because we wouldn't have anything to protect anymore. So,
I'm coming from a completely non-Buddhist point of view, because I'm like really new to this whole realm.
Because you're what, sorry, didn't
I'm completely new. But I think it's a really amazing idea, because it pulls people closer together, and it's like, it's not so much about the personalities anymore, but it's more about the core, animalistic, as in, that's just what we are, the common things that we have, kind of thing. That's how I'm seeing.
Okay, so it's what you're saying, that you're the, thinking like this, the first thing that happens when you think like this is you see, well, everybody's just in the same boat, and we're all kind of caught with this root delusion, and we're all... Yeah, is that what you mean?
We're just like what you said, we're building everything out, we're creating, designing a persona as we live on. But then the knowledge that that's actually just an illusion, that's not real, because after all, we all know that we could actually just throw it all away and just be the real self, and not like we would actually do it, but then it is possible. We know that there's something deeper inside that's very universal and true to everyone.
Okay, so it sounds like it's giving us a sort of sense of connectedness.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I'll keep going and see if we can... We get a bit limited by language, because even sort of... It's hard to talk about this, because we are limited by language, but in a way we need to even be careful for saying truths. We need to be careful of anything that kind of fixes the experience. But one thing you could say is... I think it's true to say that you can start to see that we're in the same boat, that people are in the same boat as having this delusion, pushing things away, pulling things towards us, because we tend to polarise around that when we see each other doing that, but it could be a point of connection, even compassion, you could say, to see that we're in the same boat. Yeah. Is there any other questions on what I've said, on this little bit that I've said so far? So is it I think the important thing is that this isn't saying that we don't exist at all, It's not that there's nothing there, there is experience. How does that sound to people? Does it...
Yeah.
It sounds a bit, unless I've got it wrong, that the delusion of self, the story of the self that you believe in, is a bit of a barrier to appreciating sort of a wider dream, deeper truth. When you're talking about faith, there's a thing I heard once. Someone said, belief is a clinging and faith is a letting go.
It
feels a bit like if you could just stop clinging to delusional self, then you would be open to and that be the emotional content, the appreciation would be openness to it rather than the striving or
I think that's exactly, I think that's it, and I think it's good to see that would be the immediate result of it, that you'd feel open, you'd feel connected, Okay,
Can animals ever be enlightened?
Well, in a way, I'll not dwell on that, because in a way I want to move on, but I guess I suppose Buddhism isn't drawn such a fixed distinction between the state of what we might usually call human and animal. In a sense, there'd be a sort of gradation. I suppose in the sort of Judeo-Christian sort of beliefs, you'd have a belief in a soul, and humans would have a soul, and animals wouldn't. But the first thing that you would, what distinguishes what we call broadly a human state is self-consciousness or reflexive consciousness. And you need to be aware that you can be aware in order to work on your mind. So you need to have that. And most animals, on the whole, animals haven't got that. On the whole, some humans haven't even got that, in a sense. So I mean, one thing that one can sort of just practice bringing into awareness, just to, in a way, start to get a bit of a taste of that there's more to us than we usually think, is just to pay more attention to the different types of consciousness that we experience. For example, there's the whole world of dreams and dream consciousness. Like, we're used to sort of privileging our waking sort of life as the real experience. We think, oh, that's real, or it was just a dream. But in a sense, I mean, you know, you could argue the opposite. You know, you could argue, well, why do we sort of privilege that over that? So we can see that there's a whole world of, for example, dream consciousness. And particularly for us as Buddhists, we can pay attention to the whole realm of meditation and the meditative consciousness, You know, if we meditate, especially on retreat, I mean, often when we just come to the class here, we're kind of doing well if we manage to sort of settle down a bit from our sort of busy days at work or whatever. But especially when you're on retreat or you have a chance to meditate for longer, you can start to enter into deeper dimensions of your mind in a kind of more integrated and sustained way. You might get glimpses of it, or maybe more than glimpses in your day-to-day life. But on retreat, that can be more sustained. So you can dwell in a way that kind of goes beyond our usual sort of material experience of ourselves. And it's really, really important to... It starts to sort of expand your horizons of what you think you are, really, So that's why we emphasise meditation, as well as, you know, transforming our states of mind to more skillful states of mind. You start to be able to, well, you just get this feeling that you've got more inner resources and more inner resources that you can rely on. That you actually, the depths of your mind are a source of sustenance and nourishment, that even if you were to lose your material possessions, you wouldn't have lost everything. Actually, you'd have actually have lost very little, in a sense, if you cultivate this inner richness. I mean, you can do that through art and poetry and so on as well. So here's what, I'll just read you a little bit that Sangharakshita says. He says, not only is the I only one small aspect of the self, it's also one that's constantly changing. And he says that as you start to see that more and more, he says you just start to see that the ego, with all its little anxieties, all its little resentments, basically isn't as important as it thinks it is. Yeah? You start to sort of take yourself a bit less seriously in a way. You start to take the sort of drama of your life a bit less seriously. You start to just, yeah, be able to see it as something, well, that's just changing all the time. A bit like the weather, really. I just suddenly had a little image of a little video I just recently saw of my little nephew. I mean, it's probably, I don't know if it's kind of poignant that his parents even videoed him in this state, but he was only about four or something, and he's on holiday, and there's a castle, they're going to see the castle. But he gets to the gate, and the gate's locked, and he just, like, bursts into tears, you know, he's, like, weeping and wailing, and, you know, it's like the end of this, it looks like if you didn't know that this was it, you'd think you'd been terribly cruelly treated, you know, but that's what it's like when you're a child, isn't it? Everything, you know, you take terribly emotionally seriously, so just as adults, we can smile fondly at little four-year-old Jack, kind of wailing because the castle's locked. You know, a Buddha would kind of, I almost imagine the Buddha would just smile at us fondly as, like, all the dramas and upsets we get into. You know, we think what's important isn't important, and vice versa. You know, we don't see what's really important. We think, you know, the fact it rained on our holiday or something. You know, we can get terribly upset about relatively small things. So as we get more perspective, we can just start to see that just flows. And we can, it's almost, I don't know, I almost imagine it would be with a fondness to it. It's not that we're judging ourselves harshly for doing that. We just kind of say, oh yeah, there goes my mind again, getting upset because of this or that. We can start to take it less seriously. So, here's a bit that I like. So Sangharaj just says, he says, our conception of separate being arises from the conception of I. Okay, so we've got that, I think. But on the other hand, he says, this is not to say that without the conception of I, you have non-being. He says, without the I, you have neither being nor non-being. So it's not just that you've got the I and then you get rid of it and then you don't have a being anymore. It's something far more deep and subtle than that. He said, without the I, you have neither being nor non-being. And he said, the I thought is the seed from which our sense of being arises. So he says, it's like, taking this image of the seed, he said, enveloping the seed of being, then you have a wider conception of mine. Represent, that's all your possession. So you've got, so it's like first you've got an I, yeah, and then immediately you've got mine, you've got everything that's mine. So here am I, sitting in the midst of my possessions, you know, my house, my car, if you've got one, my land, my partner, my whatever, you know, football team or whatever it happens to be, my religion even. It happens so quickly, doesn't it? So quickly. Like you've only, you know, do you ever have that experience of somebody, somebody gives you something, or maybe you win something, or maybe you get a free gift or something, and like immediately you start protecting it. And like a minute ago you didn't even have it, you know, you didn't even know of its existence. Do you know that feeling? I noticed that the other day I was on retreat and some I wasn't one of the leaders, but some people had a whip round for the leaders. And so they got given this present of this whip round. And then you could see them immediately thinking, what should we spend it on? You know, but it was like a minute ago, they didn't even have it. And then as soon as you get it, you've got to protect it or decide what to spend it on. It's so quick. So we have the eye and then we have the mind. And they're completely intertwined, the eye and the mind. And Sangharaj just says it's like all our possessions act like a kind of a tent for protecting the conception of I. It's like they create a cocoon or an envelope to protect this sense of I. And of course, it protects, but it also limits. And I've told this little story before, but it's a delightful little story which reminded me of reading this. So I've got a friend who, she was doing one of these kind of very wild camping things like I never do, where she was walking in the mountains and just sleeping outside in the mountains. And she said the first night she pitched her little tent and she was inside her tent and she could hear all these creepy crawlies outside. She said she was absolutely terrified. And she didn't sleep all night for the fear of all these noises she could hear outside. And the next day she woke up and she was really tired and she also was a bit worried because they were trekking all day. And she thought, well, I can't afford to lose another night's sleep. What am I going to do? And what do you think she did? I mean, it was totally counterintuitive what she did. Any guesses at what she did? See the pain in the nose. What did she do?
She stepped outside.
Yes, she stepped outside without the tent. And then she wasn't frightened because there was no outside to be frightened of. So she couldn't be frightened of what was outside because there was no outside. She'd taken away the outside. It was all outside. I thought that was brilliant, and I thought that was a really good sort of analogy for, because our instinct, isn't it, is to make even more of a fortress. You know, you'd intuitively think, well, I better build a stronger wall, you know, build a house somehow instead of the tent. But actually you take away the tent, and then she took away, by taking away the outside, you can't be frightened of the outside. So I like that, that sort of illustrates how it, you think, what we think it protects limits, but it also illustrates how this whole thing is totally counterintuitive. So we're not to be blamed for this. Buddhism doesn't attach any blame for us wanting to protect, yeah, because it's just, that's totally understandable, and that's where we can understand each other. We can see, well, if you see somebody being a bit selfish or something, instead of judging them, you could just think, oh well, you know, they're only trying to do that thing, you know, that we all do, you know, actually. I like that idea of we're all in the same boat doing it, so there's no blame with it, but at the same time what Buddhism is saying, we'll suffer because of it, because actually was she actually safe in the tent? I mean, actually she wasn't anyway. It was an illusion of safety, the tent anyway. You know, if a tiger was going to come, the tent's not going to save her anyway, you know. So in a sense, it's not, we're not really safe, and we're not actually making ourselves safe by putting this tent round us. We're creating an illusion of safety. So the Buddha's not blaming us for doing this. The Buddha's teaching's trying to say, look, you could be free, yeah? So, and the Buddha's not, he's not trying to take anything away from us. The Buddha's trying to say, look, don't you see, oh, look at the time. So I better just read this little last bit. So I just quickly read the little last bit. So, what Sangharaj is just saying, actually this isn't the end of the chapter, but I'll just finish here. He says, probably the best thing to do is, rather than thinking like we've got this ego that we've got to somehow get rid of, is simply to see ourselves as limited. So he says, instead of challenging ourselves to explode our deluded conception of self directly. He says it may be more helpful to think of breaking out of the closed circle of self-interest that is the emotional expression of our delusion. Yes, so that's back to what you were saying earlier. So we can just think of expanding that circle of self-interest. So how do we expand on this? What's a way that we all know that we can expand our circle of self-interest?
Generosity.
Generosity, generosity and metta. Yeah, so metta and generosity. It's, you know, you could even say it's a kind of as simple in a way as that. So we can expand our circle through the cultivation of metta, of generosity, of loving kindness, until our self-interest is absorbed in a concern of the welfare for all beings. And so in that way, again, it kind of brings us around full circles, because it means that overcoming ego, overcoming this root delusion isn't just an idea. It's a way of life, and I think that brings us back again to a couple of things people were saying about how we relate to other people and so on. So it's a way of life. It's we're trying to, instead of closing in on ourselves, when we close in on ourselves, we shut off from other people. But what we're trying to do is to have an expansive outward movement. Yeah. So I'll just finish by what Sangharaja says at the end of the chapter. He says, as a result of that spiraling outwards of one's being, our experience isn't no longer fixed and rigid and closed. So you become so expansive and so engaged with and interested in the needs of other people that you can't go back to that old constrained way of being. It just actually doesn't exist anymore. There's nothing to go back to. It's like what you're doing is you're trying to get the process of your expansion to gather more and more momentum so that it becomes irreversible. And so it's not that you've sort of jettisoned this thing called the ego as if it was some sort of extra baggage that you don't need anymore. It's actually more like the whole momentum of your being is so creative and so outward looking that to behave selfishly has become completely impossible, that would completely go against your nature. It's that point where to be selfish anymore would completely go against your nature, that you could say is what Buddhism's trying to, what all the practices are pointing towards. And that is wisdom. Yeah, that's not wisdom, that is wisdom. So that was a bit of a little whistle stop tour. So I'd get this if I was you. and keep practicing the metta bhavana. Okay, thank you.